This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. We're on segment number three. Let's head to the courtroom.
Jury is present, sir.
All right, thank you. Make proceed.
Doug, if you don't mind pulling up defense 192, please. Just another summary photo. Are you sure that's 192? Yeah, there we go. Is that the pic the same?
It's the same basic area. I mean, we can highlight here, again, there are larger pieces of brain-like matter or tissue, bone fragments here, and here, and there's even more that are beyond placard number one.
Now, Dr. Kenzie, and relying upon Dr. Reamer, where does he have Paul being shot? On this side or on the other side, or do you know?
Well, with his claim of it coming from the left shoulder and the left side of the face, he'll always have to be, the weapon will always have to be lower than that area and to the left side of the victim, of Paul.
Well, from the spatter on the floor here, in your opinion, where's Paul physically located at the time of the shot?
He's right here. He is right up against that doorway.
And where's the shooter?
Shooter cannot be there because Paul is there. The shooter's going to be in the same doorway area, probably even, you know, maybe 1 foot there and 1 foot in, but adjacent to the open door, the opposite side of the door.
Do you see what's referred to as a voiding area on that door?
Yes.
All right, let's look at State's Exhibit 26, which is already in evidence.
Well, and...
Please pull it.
Okay. And if you...
Hold up. Don't move on yet, though. Well...
I say we could actually see on the floor there.
Okay, Doug, go back to 192, I believe, is what we were looking at.
So if you look at the area immediately...
Let's stop right there. What's a voiding area?
Oh, so a voiding area is an area where we would expect, looking at all the other areas around it, to see blood stain. So in other words, in this case, you really have blood projecting everywhere just because of the voluminous explosion of the head. And so if we look at an area that seems like it has less blood than the immediate adjacent areas, then the best explanation for that is something was there to block it and capture. That is to say that blood didn't make it to the floor and didn't make it to the door because it's physically on the body of the shooter, and that's now gone. It's left the scene.
So point out the voiding area that you see?
Again, with the shooter standing in this area here, which is the door side of the door jamb, right, there is much less blood. Now, again, there is some here, but if I'm standing here and blood is being projected all the way up and showering all the way down, in addition to this big stream of it's coming this way, then of course droplets can still kind of make their way up and come down and come here and around, just not as many. My presence here is going to absorb a lot of those droplets, but not all of those droplets. And so we see much less of that blood here. And if you look at the face of the door, the lower half of the door, there's much less than there is above it. Again, where you see some droplets on it, yes, but actually most of those droplets, when you really look at them, have a downward trajectory, which is, again, very consistent with them coming up and over and downward. So it's by volume, there's less blood there than we're seeing in the immediate adjacent areas, and the reasonable explanation for that is that we have a voiding effect taking place.
Let's go to State's Exhibit 26, Doug. Okay. If you could sort of blow up the door, please.
Yeah, you don't. You almost don't have to. You can.
Okay. Well, that doesn't really help when you do that.
Yeah, if you go back to the original, it helps. So,
literally across the whole top of the door, but most particularly in the upper left corner, right by the hinge side, the upper top, you see large, large amounts of blood transfer. You see what looks like a contact transfer of material. And as we blow up on that area, we'll see, you know, bits of what looked like brain debris. We'll see lots and lots of hair in that area. This is also the area where we saw that pellet impact. So this is exact, you know, following the barrel back up for the shooter, this is the area right in alignment with this that you're seeing up here on the upper part of the door. And that's where there is a very substantial amount.
Does that indicate it went above the shooter?
Well, as I was going to say, if that volume is there and that much is coming back, then logically, why are we seeing such diminished below that? Why is that, you know, yes, there's blood there, but the volume difference between that is substantial. And that can be explained by, again, the fact that is a shooter location, and much of the blood, not all of it, but much of it, is being transferred onto their clothing.
Okay. And?
Or face, or hands, or them, or the gun.
How off the ground does Paul have to be for that much blood to go up that high?
Well, I think that the best, we have some pretty good data as to where Paul's head was because of that secondary impact location that I showed you. The exit portion of his head has got to be in that general vicinity. Obviously, the 8 or 10 inches off is where the entrance part of it is. But that does give us a pretty good approximation of where Paul's head was when that shot occurred.
So 2 feet off the ground? 3 feet?
Not even.
Okay. Is there enough force to send his hair to the top of the door?
Well, clearly there was, because we see it. I mean, yes.
Okay. All right. I have a few more door photos. Finish 193, and nope. Do you have any objection? I'm gonna show you while you're down here. Defendant's 193, and is that a photo that you rely upon?
It is.
In
yes.
Your analysis.
It is.
And Your Honor, we moved defendant's 193 in evidence without objection and under seal at this time.
No objection.
Submitted.
Thank you. Doug, can you pull up 193? And you just hold it right there. Can you tell us what that is?
So now that we're looking at a little closer view of just the top of the door, again, you can see the extent of the blood spatter in this area of the door, and then also the adjacent area of the door trim. Of note isn't also that it's there and there's lots of it, but lots of it is quite small. And in the blood stain analysis field, what makes blood droplets smaller is by increased energy. So as we start seeing an accumulation of droplets, which we do on the trim up here and also on this door here, that means that they are subjected to much more energy and then virtually the other droplets we're seeing around the room, and that's because these are the ones that are coming directly back under the explosive power coming out of the entrance hole and moving up much of it into the shooter, some of it up and over and into the ceiling and the top of the door.
Doug, can you blow up the third? Well, hang on. Do you see the pellet in the threshold of the door on this?
Yes, it's going to be in this area right here.
Can you find it and blow it up, Doug? I think you missed another.
Well, one. Yeah, he got the other pellet. Yeah, he got the actual pellet, and that is the actual pellet. And then I was pointing, which is here, I believe, is right here. Yeah. And that's the actual physical pellet that was observed in the door.
So this photo is from the crime scene.
Correct.
Right. And when you went out Friday, did you see that exact pellet?
I did.
And tell the jury again, in your opinion, how that pellet got there?
It has been projected back along the axis again of the barrel of the gun because of this high voluminous material that's now escaped and is pushing back out the entrance hole
and it's moving all this material with a lot of energy, a lot of velocity back up in this corner.
Now, Mr. Palmback, if the shooter was on the outside and angling toward Paul's shoulder and up through his head and out the top of his ceiling, would you expect pellet and the markings on the door to be in that area?
Well, for starters, I wouldn't expect the patterns. In the scenario where the top of the head is going to be the terminal point of the gunshot, in other words, of the theory that it started in the left shoulder, went to the left cheek, went into the head, I do not believe that you'd even have a fracture of the skull. You wouldn't even have an exit wound. That those pellets, because of two reasons, mostly, it's not contact. All that gaseous material is not going up into the cranial vault. It's just going freeform, so that's you don't get any of the explosive value. And secondarily, the number two pellets are much lighter. Their mass is less. And so they're not going to have the energy that's necessary, particularly after moving through a shoulder, through a face, and up through the brain, to penetrate and break out of the skull. I think you wouldn't even see any of them outside of the skull. You certainly would not see that rearward projection or blast of blood and hair and bone and pellets that we did see.
I'm going to show you exhibit 181, 183, 188, and 186. And can you identify these as, are those photos you took on Friday?
They are.
Yeah, okay. We would move 181, 183, 186, and 188 into evidence at this time without objection.
No objection.
Here, no doubt.
Just work quickly through these. Exhibit 181. Well, let's don't do this. Let's go to 188, Doug, and tell me what 188 is.
So this is an overall photo of that same area of the door that I took on Friday, and you can see the impact dent right here in that upper corner. Same relative position as you saw it in the crime scene photos.
Can you also see the pellet lodged in the...
Yes. Yep. And the actual pellet is up here on the door trim, and again, it's in the same relative position as observed in the crime scene photos.
Okay. And then... Yes, let's look at 181 and just briefly point out 181, Doug. Thank you.
So this is a close-up view, 90 degree on, of that pellet up in the up into the door trim, and what it's demonstrating is a couple things. One, that it is a steel pellet. You can see the coloration. You can also see that the diameter fits the general profile diameter of a number two pellet. A number two pellet is 0.15 inches or 3.8 millimeters. And so if you, unfortunately, this particular protractor and ruler had it backwards. You have to kind of protract down, but that is very consistent with that 3.8 millimeter.
Okay.
So this is just to demonstrate that it's actually embedded into the wood, and it's the right kind of structure and size of what the number two pellet would be.
And 186, please, Doug. 186.
Yep.
Just tell us what that is, Mr. Palmbach.
So that's a close-up. That's actually a close-up of that impression on the metal door that we saw. And you can see that it's kind of oblong in shape, and it's more round and fatter here toward the bottom. And again, and the resist ruler, by the way, is running parallel to the floor, and the floor is below it. And then it tapers off angularly this way, which shows the directionality. That pallet is actually coming in an upward direction. It's not coming straight on.
Lastly, I'm going to show you on this set, defendant's 182. Can you identify that?
Yes, I can.
What is it?
It's a picture of me on the external part of the doorway, just showing what the relative positioning would have to be to hold the shotgun in roughly the positioning that Dr. Kinsey was alluding to.
All right, and Your Honor, we would move to introduce Defendant's Exhibit 182 in evidence, plea without objection.
No objection.
Can you pull up 182, please?
So, as you can see, I'm crouched very tightly against the right doorway. It's about as far over as I could go, and still, I was trying to, how far can I go over and still manage, you know, a firearm in this kind of relative position here? Right out of the gate, what you realize is my body is physically in the position where Paul is passing through, and we previously identified this area right here, like right in my right shin area, you know, about a foot off the floor, and here where I'm seeing the impact spatter associated with the exit out of the lower face and into his shoulder. So Paul is moving through here, and his head's at about this location, very close to this door, and then outside of the door where we finally found him. And it's in that location that from the other side, the shotgun comes down into his head. The other thing that I wanted to show in this photograph, and it should be noted that you see a shelf here on the right, that's a change from the original scene. Not that shelf is the same, the best I can determine, but they cut out the rest of it. So, you know, it actually went down the whole length of that wall. There was a refrigerator on it and other objects. And if you look at the distance between the edge of that shelf, it's 4 inches or so. It's not possible that the shooter could have gotten in the room, and they had, there's just not enough room for them to be on the left side of Paul. So they would have to be outside reaching in with the shotgun in order for that to happen, but in my attempt to do that, I was in the wrong location. And I think a couple of critical things about that is, again, we do not know the length of the gun because we don't have it, so I don't know how long it is. You know, but we can make a general assumption. This would be pretty short. It would be probably longer than that. But because there was no observed, and nobody talked about seeing any gunshot residue, even on the shoulder of Paul, then you've got to have, again, a minimum, and that area was fairly well exposed, at 2 to 3 feet minimum, where the barrel would have to be. So if the barrel was placed inside on the floor, and an upward, again, so it's got to come across the shoulder, upward, and out the back. It's this kind of a trajectory. You can't even have the shoulder until about 2 feet from there, and then the side of the head here, and Paul's head here. None of that creates a pattern consistent with anything that we see. Now, that would account for a lack of gunshot residue if that was true. But what it definitely would have changed is the pellets coming out of here now would have definitely begun to spread, and you would have seen pellets all across the side of his left side of his face, which you didn't. And then finally, if you look at this angle here, again, imagine door here, gun in this thing, then even if, and I think there's no evidence of it, but even if the shot could go through Paul's head and create an exit pathway, then that would project whatever pellets and bone matter that way. Whereas, if you move the shooter to the other side and we shoot into Paul downward this way, then all of this material comes back at the shooter, but also it's going this way into that upper corner, which is where we see the pellet defects and the heavy blood and the hair.
Okay, and you'll take a seat. That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you. You can take that down, Doug. Mr. Palmback, let's talk a little bit about the reconstruction of murder of Maggie Murdoch. Did you assess the crime scene as it relates to her?
I did.
And what your observations?
Well, generally, there's a couple really key observations. One, all of her wounds were facing the direction of the shooter. So at all times during this, her shooting, she's facing the shooter. Now, she is moving, for sure. There is some degree of movement, you know, from where the initial shooting most likely occurred, which is, we can't give you an accurate estimation for that. We can give you a really good estimation where it ended, and that's where we find her. And I'll talk about which wounds were associated with that in a minute. But you, so you have her facing the attacker the entire time. At no point did she turn or blade or anything other than face him, and moved a little bit in the area, although not much. And then the shooter, based on the overall distribution of the shell casings, also moved, again, somewhat, moving, you know, toward where the ultimate location where we find Maggie.
I'm going to show you two photos. Defense Exhibit 163 and 164, and ask if you relied upon those.
I did.
Defense Exhibit 163 and 64 in evidence at this time with advocate.
No objection.
Submit it.
If you don't mind pulling out 163, Doug. Thank you. And jury's seen this, but just give us an overview of what this is.
Well, so Maggie is underneath the blanket there, and she's in a face-down position there.
Just leave it like that. Don't
we? Her head is more toward us, and her feet are pointing more toward, I think, what's been identified as a doghouse.
Right.
You'll see placards in the foreground, 3 and 4, which are two of the blackout 300 casings. You'll see a placard 12, which is over on the grass, more in alignment. You know, we're heading more toward Maggie's head area, and that was a large piece of what appears to be brain-like material. And while you can't see the numbering, there are additional placards to the left, immediately to the left side. Well, they're on Maggie's right side, but as we view the photograph, they're to the left of where she's currently located. So this just gives us some general orientation of approximate locations of the shooter, and certainly where at least the fatal shot to Maggie was taken.
Right. I'm going to show you Defense Exhibit 149. And the other two we'd move that those be under seal, and 149 under seal. Is this, can you rely upon this in reaching your conclusions?
I did.
Your Honor, we'd move, Exhibit 194, not 149. 194 in evidence, under seal at this time.
No objection.
Submit it.
And if you don't mind pulling up, Doug, well, before I do that, let's go to 164, and which is a closer-up area around the side-by-side, as they call it. What's the significance of this photo?
Again, I think this is an area in which Maggie passed by during this incident. It's also an area that's being highlighted now where what appears to be her damaged loop earring, which is consistent in shape and design and structure to the one that's still in her right ear. This one would have come out of her left ear at the time of that impact, shot to her left ear, and more or less just been blown over this direction.
And the jury has seen the autopsy photo of the injury to her left ear. Is this, do you believe this earring is a byproduct of that injury?
I do.
Okay. And then just briefly, I'm going to pull up 194 and ask if you can just generally, I think you were hair on her body. What significance is that? And if you'll blow up her legs.
Right.
Doug, please.
So, you know, when you find a body, you always have to wonder, is that really the position that the body remained in? Or, you know, through medical, you know, maybe the defendant did, or the accused or the shooter did something to the body. More likely, in a medical evaluation, they did something to it. We always just want to know, are we looking at it in the right orientation? Did somebody flip it over and whatnot? And so I think it was valuable to, in this case, to have seen that injury in the back of her head, the massive amount of hair that came off of that. And then if you look close up on the back of her legs, you'll see just dozens and dozens of hairs laying on top of her legs, which would be a good indicator that she didn't get moved. We can count on this being the final position, unaltered position at Magnet.
Doug, can you go back to 163? You mentioned a marker 12 a moment ago in 163, and again, what do you understand 12 to be?
It's physiological material. I mean, it looks structurally like brain material, but it's tissue.
In your opinion, would the shooter of Maggie have any blood spatter, blood, biological material on him or her?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible because, as we're seeing here, that you have a projection of brain material backwards toward the direction of where the shooter would have been located. We also have a couple of the shots, the left thigh shot and the abdomen shot, which have been identified as having stippling around them. By virtue of being stippling, that does make it an intermediate distance, and that's going to move the shooter in anywhere from, I would agree. I think Dr. Hines said a foot to 3 feet is probably a good approximation.
Okay. Mr. Palmbach, do you have an opinion based upon more probably than not, whether there was one or two shooters who murdered Maggie and Paul on the night of June 7th?
I do have an opinion on that.
And what's your opinion?
My opinion is the totality of the evidence is more suggestive of a two-shooter scenario.
And what, I mean, please explain the basis of your opinion.
Okay. So we'll go back to Paul. In Paul's scenario, we know where the shooter of the shotgun had to be, and that would have been orientated really directly over Paul's head. And we also got a chance to see what was the effect of this dynamic explosion in the contact. And you can see outside and even in throughout the feet area in multiple and many large pieces of skull. We also saw large amounts of tissue that were projected all the way up onto the ceiling and the door. You see hair all the way up into the door, and of course you see blood literally everywhere within there. And finally, you see the pellets. Some of the pellets are on that same pathway, and they had enough inertia to either and or dent the door put themselves up and stick into the casing. All of that activity was in direct alignment with the shooter. And so I think minimally, that shooter is getting covered with this material, getting more or less the shock wave of that effect, and more than likely getting hit with at least something that could have done injury, a bone fragment and or a pellet fragment. Therefore, I think that particular shooter, for a brief period of time, is kind of out of this. It's not as if they can instantaneously suffer that, drop the shotgun, run to wherever the AR, the blackout rifle is, pick that up, and then in any kind of a reasonable time period, engage in a meaningful assault, an effective assault, able to shoot straight and make hits. So that, I think, is one of the major indicators of concern. I think the other things to consider is that all of this is very temporal. It's very close. I know when I looked at the photographs versus being there, I'm like, it is much closer together than it looks like in the photo. So it is happening very close. With Paul, as I articulated, I believe he was shot first. I believe he had no idea it was coming. And he took the shot to the chest, and very soon thereafter, the one in the back of his head. anybody in the near proximity to that, if Maggie had been anywhere in that area walking around down there, she would have heard that. And her response would have been in the direction of the shooter or the activity, or run, or do something different. So I think that the temporal location suggests that these things more probable than not happened fairly quickly, and that the individual who shot first with the shotgun minimally was stunned, probably blood and material in his eyes, and maybe have been injured, and would have taken some degree of time to recover. And lastly, I think there is just more or less in the anybody who deals with firearms a logical argument here. Why would one shooter bring two long rifles, two long weapons to the event? You can't handle and shoot two of them. So you either got to put one down, use one, and then swap out and grab the other one. Or I suppose you could have one on a sling, but that's quite awkward, and it's slipping around and it's banging around in an environment we know is very, very tight. Finally, if one of the weapons is the Blackout 300, well, that comes with a high magazine capacity. My research of that showed that the Palmetto State Armory upper, which we don't know, we have no idea what gun this is because it hasn't been identified. But if the state, I think, has alluded to that, if that's the case, then a weapon that had that Palmetto State Armory in a 300 Blackout, a person could purchase a 10-round capacity clip, a 20-round capacity clip, or a 30-round capacity clip. Where I live in Connecticut, we are really restrictive on what kind of weapons we can have and what kind of clips we could have. We'd have to, even if we could have an AR, which is very restrictive, we'd have to get a 10-round clip. Other than that, it wouldn't make sense for anybody to buy a 10-round clip when you could buy a 20 or 30. But having said that, if it was a 10-round clip, there were only 8 shots fired. You still had 2 more to go, and you could have more than not easily reloaded. So to me, there's structurally difficult for the same shooter to have 2 long arms, and no practical reason for that to happen. Add that to what I believe happened to the shooter who fired first with the shotgun, and I think it tips in favor of the probability of 2 shooters.
Mr. Palmbach, the person who shot Paul, was he or she standing in the feed room at least 1 foot?
Yes.
Was there an opportunity to do a footprint analysis to illuminate more clearly the existence of footprints there?
For sure. I can speak for myself, and I believe others have opined about this, including some of the analysts in the case. There are what appear to be partial footprints in blood in the feed room and on the cement around it. And while I'm not a footwear pattern expert, I can generally recognize what appears to be footwear or partial footwear impressions. I would agree with that. But in order to go beyond it's a general pattern to something more specific, that generally what you do, and I've done this countless times, is you spray enhancement reagents on them. And you spray a reagent, we generally call them blood pattern enhancement reagent, or you can even use a straight protein spray. Imidio Black would be an example of one of those. And by spraying those reagents in the area, it reacts with the presence of blood or proteins, and it brings up the transformation. It gives you a lot more clarity, a lot more detail, and you can tell an awful lot more about a particular footwear pattern. Absolutely should have been done in this case. And I also believe, second to that, you had a lot of dirt in the immediate area that should have had at least partial footwear impressions. And I saw no indication of any attempt to either look for it, photograph it, properly photograph it, or analyze it.
And thank you. One moment, Your Honor. And did Mr. Palmbach, did you see any fingerprint analysis or attempts to obtain fingerprints from the feed room area?
I did not. Okay.
Could you have used reagents like you described to enhance fingerprints? Or is that a whole different methodology?
Well, if you thought that the fingerprints could contain blood, which maybe they usually could have, then yes, you could also use those reagents to enhance partially or fully bloody fingerprints. But I think you could also use basic fingerprint processing techniques on the door and any surface in the area. Since we know this is a very confined area and the shooter has to be in that general area and the possibility of touching something is there. I mean, I think it would have been wise to look for that.
Thank you. That's all I have. Please answer any questions the state may have.
By the state.
Dr. Palmbach?
No, ma'am. I'm not a doctor.
Okay, I want to get it right. Now, you said you were hired by the defense to investigate and come up with your own conclusions here. And you just got the chance to go out to Moselle, was it last Friday?
That's correct.
And so between last Friday and today, you've had the chance to determine all of these things you've testified about.
No. Before I arrived here, everything else was predetermined, and I had done all the work in the analysis. What I didn't know or didn't perceive was these two pellets and the fact that the energy was able to project two pellets upward. That was the only new information to me.
And you form your opinion by reviewing reports and things that were provided to you by the defense?
Correct.
Do you know if you reviewed the entire case file?
No, I wouldn't know that.
You just reviewed materials that were provided to you.
Correct.
And did you prepare any kind of report?
I did not.
You did not?
Correct.
But you did review reports made by Dr. Kenny Kinsey and a pathologist and other witnesses for the state.
I did.
All right, let's talk about the feed room a little bit. You testified a lot about that. Now, you said the shooter stepped in the feed room, could have stepped in the feed room to shoot Paul in the back of the head.
Correct.
And when he would have shot Paul, he would have been covered in blood.
As a result of the back spatter from the headshot, yes.
Covered in blood.
Yes.
And in the picture of the feed room, were there any other bloody footprints clearly apparent?
Any other?
Yes.
Other than what?
Other than Paul's footprints.
Well, all I've seen is partial footprints that have been observed in the feed room. I've yet to read a report that said conclusively they were Paul's.
I'm going to show you states 27. And there have been testimony that those footprints we're looking at do belong to Paul Murdaugh. Were there any other clearly visible footprints that you can see in that picture from a bloody shooter?
So first of all, and again, I am not a footwear examiner, so I'm not going to make a determination about whether or not it definitively is Paul Murdaugh's shoe. All of the reports I've read generated by the state, the ones that I've seen, would say that they didn't exclude it, but that also does not mean that it's Paul's. Now, I'm not disagreeing that it doesn't maybe have some characteristics in similar, but I don't know that they're even at a point where that has been fully identified as Paul's.
So you haven't seen the report that identified those as Paul's footprints?
Definitively identified them as Paul's? No, I did not.
You only saw the reports the defense wanted you to see.
I got the reports that were supplied to me, yes.
Now about the damage to the door, we saw this picture where there is blood in the corner of the door frame. That was the defense's exhibit. Defense exhibit 165. And I think we were emphasizing the blood in the right corner, the bottom of the door frame there?
Yes.
Were there any defects from pellets in the door frame down there?
Not that I saw.
Because defects were in the top of the door, right?
That is correct.
And you referred to Paul being shot in the back of the head, kind of like an explosion.
Correct.
And I'm not a physicist or anything here, but when you fire a shotgun, things are going in a direction that the gun is fired, right?
Correct.
So there wouldn't be just like a boom explosion like from a bomb when you fire a shotgun.
Actually, that's more exactly what it would be like, yes.
So you're saying a shotgun, when you fire it, the impact is all around like a bomb instead of in the direction the gun is fired?
Only when you confine it. And again, that's why it makes the classical determination of a contact wound in something like the cranium. It's not, you shoot a person anywhere else, you will not trap the gaseous material and allow the pressure to build up within eventually. Yeah, it does look like a bomb going off. That only happens in a cranial vault.
So if there was an explosion of this type, wouldn't Paul's whole head be blown off?
I'd say the fact that his entire brain came out and a large portion of his skull is missing, that's pretty dynamic. I don't know how much more you want.
But his brain wasn't destroyed, was it?
There were pieces of his brain throughout the room, and including out on the ground.
Most of his brain was intact, right?
The majority of the structure was physically together, but whether it was injured is absolutely not for me to decide. That's a pathologist that needs to do that.
I believe you testified that his brain was a mass on the ground?
Yes.
And his face wasn't destroyed either from this explosion, was it?
No, because, again, if the energy source is going to find the easiest egress, and that is where the entrance hole came. So that's why that explosive value did not go down with the shot, which is kind of the logical inference that it all should come this way or this way or his left. But in this capacity, because this is in this seal vault, this is this large hole there, then you get kind of a shift, and all of this now starts pushing back that way, following the exit point out the entrance hole.
And you're talking about pushing up, but the shooter was firing down?
The explosive release of the gas trapped in the cranium will push back upward in the direction of where the barrel was. Absolutely, some of the projectile and energy has gone through the brain, exited the left side of the face, and into the shoulder, and created exactly that pattern that you were pointing to a minute ago on the door jamb.
So all these pellets that were being pushed downward when they were shot, we don't have any defects downward, just upward.
Correct.
Okay.
Anything further? You may step down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll break for lunch now till 2:45. Till 2:45. Jury is excused. At 2:45, do you have another witness?
More.
All right. We'll be in recess till 2:45.
That wraps up segment number 3 of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There's much more to come. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.